Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I can tell that you all know how to have a good time because in order to prepare for an LSU football game, you came here tonight. So I know you all know what it means to have a good time. We're going to have a great time tonight talking about justice. So the question of, you know, what do we owe our neighbor? And what is, you know, justice in work? And the very short version is that we want to make a clear distinction between a moral claim, which is also an economic claim about justice, what we owe each other, as distinct from a political claim, which is about how does the government, or what is the government's role in helping us to ensure justice for employers and employees. And one of the reasons I think this is a helpful topic is because it can help to some extent at least, heal divisions that are unfortunate. We generally tend to think of kind of secular world and Catholic world and the prominent divisions in our culture, but I'm really talking about more with among Christians and specifically within the Catholic Church, that broadly we could say on one side there are the more people who call themselves Orthodox, conservative, or traditional Catholics, whether they go to a charismatic mass or like an extraordinary form, and on the other hand, progressive or social justice or liberal Catholics, that division really goes back to earlier than that, but to some of the people I'm going to be looking at tonight and thinking about just wage. And what I think, and it may be, I don't know if you would agree with this, is that generally those who would call themselves traditional, conservative, Orthodox are suspicious that social justice Catholics don't fully follow church teaching. That they kind of have a pick-and-choose attitude. They like some things in church teaching, but they don't follow others. But I think the topic of just wage is helpful, because generally it's the social justice Catholics who get really excited about this. They think it's very important that we care about the rights of workers as Catholics and as Christians more broadly, and that it's the traditional Catholics who might find themselves a little more wishing that the Pope or the bishops would stay out of politics and economics. And so it's a helpful case to see that maybe there are cases in which Catholics on both sides find themselves kind of struggling to think about church teaching and its relationship to public life. One of the people we're going to look at tonight toward the end is John Ryan. I don't know if you've heard of him, but during the New Deal in the 1930s, he was the Catholic priest out there in public championing FDR in these progressive causes, just wages. He was one of the most important influencers in the minimum wage law movement in the United States. And yet, on the other hand, he would really fit in more conservative categories. For example, he argued for the restriction of immigration in order to protect American workers. He was against contraception as an intrinsic evil and a harm to family life. He saw communism and socialism as evils, even if he could find common cause on some issues. And he was fond of saying, error has no rights, which is a very traditional Catholic claim about the preeminence of the church over the state. So the division that opened up in the church that we think of today between these two kinds of Catholics, again, it really comes out of this situation, and I think leads to the misfortune among, in some cases, in the social justice camp, of that kind of pick-and-choose attitude that is maybe more prominent today. Okay, I hope you have the handout. I know it's very long. We're not going to be looking at all of those quotes in there, but more of just a reference for you. To look at, to continue to think about these. Does anybody need the handout? Anybody not get it? Okay, good. So, introduction. The Bible and church teaching on the right to a just wage. So I want to begin by pointing out that the concept of a day's wage, the connection between work, the worker, and human need, is a biblical one. As we read in Sirach, and this is quote 1a, "The bread of the needy is the life of the poor. Whoever deprives them of it is a murderer. To take away a neighbor's living is to commit murder. To deprive an employee of wages is to shed blood." Very harsh words there. In a passage that is surely more familiar to us, think of the parable of the workers in the vineyard. I'm not going to read the parable, quote 1b there, but I would point out that we want to emphasize the focus is on grace, right? That this is a parable about grace. Jesus teaching us that those who say yes to the offer of grace, even at the moment of death, even if they rejected Christ until the end, enter the kingdom of God, even at the 11th hour. But on the literal level, the context is a daily wage, denarius. That was the conventional measure in Christ's time of what was necessary for one's livelihood. And note especially that those who get hired at 5 o'clock in verse 6 indicate that they have not been working through no fault of their own. No one has hired us, in verse 7. This should remind us of 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Anyone unwilling to work should not eat. The day's wage must be earned. We're not talking about handouts. We're talking about giving people the opportunity to earn the day's wage. But if through no fault of their own they couldn't find an employer, the landowner pays even those who didn't really put in a day's wage out of his generosity. Notice the term generosity there. Aquinas, as we'll see, considers generosity as part of justice. Think of things like opening a door for somebody who's got a package. That's actually an act of justice, that we owe it to one another to help one another out. Finally, those who want more than a day's wage, I worked all day, he only worked for a few hours, I should get more than him, are rebuffed. And this points to the fact that the measure of value is human need, not human desire. We can always desire more material things. We can always desire to get ahead, to have more than someone else. But that desire needs to be moderated, or we'll never have enough. A just wage, then, is not the amount that can buy us luxuries, but that which can buy us what we need for the kind of happiness that can only be achieved if we lay up our treasure in the next life. So this talk is not a history of philosophy and theology on wages, but we are going to get to one important person in that history. It should be obvious who that's going to be, St. Thomas Aquinas. The purpose is to understand what the church teaches today about a just wage. In order to understand this, we do need to look at the modern teaching. What does the church say? And then we need to look at how Aquinas helps us to understand what the church is teaching. So first, let's look at some of the central passages in Catholic social teaching that articulate the nature of a just wage, starting with Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum. And let me add this, that we now have another reason to reread it. Leo XIV tells us that he chose his name to show continuity with Rerum Novarum in looking at today's AI-based industrial revolution. So the current Holy Father has said, if you want to understand why I took this name, read Rerum Novarum. So that's another reason for us to be looking at. It was issued in 1891, and it really initiates the church's engagement with modern social issues in response to the industrial revolution. So quote C, let's go ahead and read the whole quote there. Let the working man and the employer make free agreements, and in particular, let them agree freely as to the wages. Nevertheless, there underlies a dictate of natural justice, more imperious and ancient than any bargain between man and man. Namely, wages ought not to be insufficient to support a frugal and well-behaved wage earner. If through necessity or fear of a worse evil, the workman accept harder conditions because an employer or contractor will afford him no better, he is made the victim of force and injustice. Even if they agreed to the terms, he has been treated unjustly by the employer. This teaching, I would argue, has been consistently upheld. Pius XI clarifying that this means to be enough to support the family. It's not just an individual contract, it's a family being supported. It was a response to a debate after Rerum Novarum was issued. And John Paul II, quote D there, indicates just remuneration for the work of an adult who is responsible for a family means remuneration which will suffice for establishing and properly maintaining a family and for providing security for its future. Another important point is that by the wage sufficient to provide for the worker and family, we don't mean bare subsistence. Anticipating some of the issues that we want to at least outline tonight, and acknowledging that we're not going to be using the terms that people use outside in the world when they talk about this, we should ask whether minimum wage, when people say a minimum wage, what does that mean? Does it mean the amount for bare subsistence? Or does it mean what's necessary for human need? While the church is less consistent in outlining what that entails. So for example, healthcare. Is that a basic need that everyone has a right to? Pope Francis provides the most recent statement of this in quote E. And I'm not going to read that there, but you can see some of the things he mentions there. As Francis indicates at the end with his point about goods for our common use, we should be less concerned with the list of these goods because these can vary. Above all, we can come first full circle to Rerum Novarum and clarify a just wage is that which is sufficient for living virtuously, which is to say for fulfilling the great commandments, loving God and neighbor as self. We need to constantly remind ourselves of this point that the measure of human need is not luxury or the American dream to define the meaning of our lives, to act out our chosen identity. That's not what we mean. What we mean is the satisfaction of the restless heart seeking God. That's what we need. See in quote F there that the need for religion, the need for participation in religious community, Sundays, holy days, rest, and so forth, celebration. To wrap up the introduction, let's note that while the teaching is clear and consistent, as we'll see when we look at Aquinas, there are distinct kinds of justice, and church teaching leaves open room as to which type is at work here. So this is where this is just not clarified in church teaching, and part of the disagreements we're going to find, especially in America, between a more, say, government regulatory view, we might say liberal or progressive, and a more laissez-faire or libertarian view on the conservative side. Okay, so Aquinas, section 2, justice, property, value, and the limits of government regulation. Okay, so the foundation for this teaching really is Aquinas, and Leo XIII is the one who initiates church social teaching by pointing to Aquinas, saying, this is the model for us to be looking to in forming Catholic intellectual culture. So what I want to do here is provide just a crash course in Aquinas' practical thought, ethics, economics, and politics. We have two goals here. First, showing that church teaching on just wage, Aquinas doesn't talk about it, but it's a coherent, consistent application of Aquinas to modern life. The second thing is that Aquinas helps us to think about it more clearly. So first, if you've had any exposure to philosophy, especially a Platonic dialogue or one of Aristotle's treatises, you know the first step is to define a term. What's our term? Justice. Quote A there. Justice is a habit whereby a man renders to each one his due by a constant and perpetual will. So the question is, what do we owe? What is owed to the worker? We also want to note that we're not talking about charity. That's a whole other set of issues. I'm a philosopher. I know a little bit about the theological part, I think, but we're focusing on the philosophical in part because we're also thinking about government. You know, so the philosophical, there are virtues like benevolence, almsgiving, and so forth that are also important, but we're not looking at those right now. So why is that important? Because Catholics, Christians in general, I think, tend to fall into this view that whatever I earn is mine, absolutely mine, and if I give it to you because you're in need, it's charity. That's not what the church teaches. So look at Catechism 24, I'm sorry, I don't have the quote for you, but Catechism 2446. When we attend to the needs of those in want, we give them what is theirs, not ours. More than performing works of mercy, we are paying a debt of justice. So church teaching is that it's a matter of justice that those who do not have what they need, you give to them their, what they need. out of what you have earned. Okay, and that is not something that our kind of American sensibilities would take up necessarily. But we also need to recognize there's different kinds of justice. First of all, commutative, which is in exchanges. You have something, I have something, and we exchange them. That value should be equal. I have work, you have products that need to be worked on or need to be created. But then there's also distributive justice, when there's a surplus. Don't worry, the government will never have a surplus for you to worry about this problem. But in families, maybe your family might have a surplus, or you are a shareholder in some way, and there's a surplus. Who gets how much of it? And there are different principles there. This is particular justice directed to the private individual. I'm not going to read that, but that's the basic distinction there. So think of transactions versus distribution of goods held in common. So let's imagine that the government found lots of gold on national forest land. Whose is it? You know, how is it distributed? Okay, the thing that will come up later on is, when it comes to distribution, it's not so clear-cut. Aquinas talks about prominence. So let's imagine we're distributing those surplus goods. One could argue, well, veterans. You know, they've contributed. There's a prominence they have because of what they've contributed to our freedom. They should get more than someone else. Someone else could say, well, what about those who have paid more tax money? What about those who are most in need? And so Aquinas, in a democracy, measures it in terms of helping to establish liberty. That's the language he uses, right? So we can see that it's a threat to liberty if there is violence due to incredible inequality. So we have to think, like, how might distribute in light of liberty? Okay, so again, this is debatable. But when the church talks about preferential love for the poor, or preferential option for the poor, some people argue that means distributing more to the poor of government surplus. Again, that's an interpretation. Some would interpret it differently. And it's our job as thoughtful people to think that through. And that's quote C, by the way, there. Okay, so two main kind of justice, commutative, distributive. All right, but now, and we need lots of diagrams, I'm sorry, try to keep some of this in your head. There are virtues that are attached to justice that they're not legal things, but they are part of being a morally good person. So remember in the parable of the vineyard worker, I mentioned generosity. Right? So when someone is struggling and you open the door for them, we don't want the police to come if you don't do that, right? And imagine you do it and they don't say thank you. We don't want laws making you say thank you. But you do owe it to people to thank them for what they do for you. Gratitude is a kind of justice in a moral, but not a legal sense. So even if we argue that the employer is not legally bound to pay the worker what he or she needs, the employer is still morally bound. Let me just throw this out now to think about, what if two employees are doing the same work and one of them has more dependents? That more people depend on them, children, than the other. Should they make the same amount? Some could argue that, well, legally they should get the same amount, but morally the employer might try to help that one in a way that recognizes the need they're in. And again, we could think about that. So I'll try to give some examples later. Okay, the final thing is there is something called legal justice or general justice. Today the church calls that social justice. Okay. There's a great confusion. People use the term social justice as if it means distributive justice. That's not what it means. You want to think of social justice as things more like this. It's quote E, and I'm not going to read that there. Let's think of a disaster, a natural disaster, and let's pray that we don't have one soon. But after a natural disaster, we recognize that citizens, at the very least, ought to get out of the way of emergency responders. At the very least, you have an obligation to be like, maybe I should get off the roads, maybe I should make sure I'm not taking more of the water and the food than I really need because it's really necessary, maybe I shouldn't interfere with communications, and maybe I have an obligation to offer up some of my time and my talents to help people I don't know, to cooperate in this endeavor of helping people in a disaster. That's a better image of social justice. directing your private virtues to help the common community. It might mean money, but it might not. For some of us, we don't have the money to give, but we have time or talents. Okay, so now that's justice. We're talking about property, though. It's important to note when we're determining what we owe to others that property isn't, absolutely speaking, mine or yours. We talk that way legally, and I think for important reasons we do that. But morally, that's not the case. Look at quote F. Man ought to possess external things not as his own, but as common, so that to wit he is ready to communicate them to others in their need. God communicates to us his love, his friendship for us, and the person of Jesus Christ offers that to all of us. We are to communicate that to all God loves, every human being, right, as we love ourselves. And so this extension of communication is a good image there for our property. I ought to communicate with my community, what do people need in my community? How can my property, like I've got an extra coat, I don't use this thing that I have, how can it be for the use for the community? Aquinas even goes so far, and this, it was as good, we have a seminar today, some people found this a little, didn't like this passage. Aquinas says, whenever certain people have in superabundance, whatever they have, is due by natural law to the purpose of succoring the poor. So if you have superabundant goods, you owe it to the poor. I don't care if you earned it. You owe it to them. Of course, the question is, what is superabundance? Like, well, what is it? Like, what's an example of that? The image we used was a good one. If you've seen Despicable Me 2, I think it is, where the guy pulls up in the big four-wheel truck, and then the next bigger one, and the next, and then is Gru the guy's name? I can't remember. I mean, now that's superabundance. That truck is way too big for the roads, right? That's superabundantly big. He should give some of that to his minions or to somebody else. Okay, so have that image when you look at trucks driving down the road next time. Is that a superabundant truck or merely abundant? Okay, so thinking about a just wage. At a bare minimum, we have to specify how all those virtues come into play. How do all of those work together? And we need to recognize Aquinas doesn't talk about a just wage, but a just price. So he doesn't talk about wages. Just wages come into play in a society in which wages are virtually the sole means of providing for human need. Very few Americans provide from their own property what they live on. You might have a nice garden in your back, and you might every once in a while get a salad, and if your garden's like mine, you get like one tomato for your whole family, you know, every once in a while. You're not really living off your garden, most of us, right? It's our salary. It's our wage. And so that's where the just price concept meets this. Look at quote H here. Buying and selling. Second half of it. Second half. Secondly, we may speak of buying and selling considered as accidentally tending to the advantage of one party and to the disadvantage of the other. For instance, when a man has a great need of a certain thing, while another man will suffer if he be without it. In such a case, the just price will depend not only on the thing sold, but on the loss which the sale brings on the seller. And thus it will be lawful to sell a thing for more than it is worth in itself, though the price paid be not more than it is worth to the owner. Yet if the one man derive a great advantage by becoming possessed of the other man's property, and the seller be not at a loss through being without that thing, the latter ought not to raise the price, because the advantage accruing to the buyer is not due to the seller, but to a circumstance affecting the buyer. Now, no man should sell what is not his, though he may charge for the loss he suffers. Okay, that's probably like, what is that getting at? Let's just think of this situation. In a wage-based economy, I need that time at work to provide for myself and my family. That's the need I have. And it may be that what I can do for you doesn't provide you with as much profit as what someone else can do. That doesn't make my need any less. Okay, so that when I say, look, I need this much to live on, If I'm going to be away from my family this many hours a week, I need enough to support them, okay? And in New York City, that's going to be more than it is, you know, in Baton Rouge and more than another place. And on the other hand, the person who is the employer who says, look, employees are a dime a dozen right now, this is the going rate, is not giving you justice. Because what he's doing is saying, that thing that you own, your labor, supporting your family, because of your need, you can't get what is necessary for yourself. I'm going to take advantage of that. That's an injustice. So I can ask for more than like the market rate based on my need, but you can't offer me less because I'm in need. So think of a situation like this, that if I were to sell something because I need to pay rent. Look, maybe this electric guitar is only worth $300 in the marketplace. Maybe that's true. I need $400. That's what I need to pay my rent. That's why I'm selling it. I'm not treating you unjustly if I ask for that. And notice that if I said that to you, you might say, okay, that's different than me just saying, like, I really want to upgrade to a nicer guitar. Right? You say, okay, I see that as a human being, I may want to care about you and give you a little more than the market rate in some cases. Okay, so on the basis of this, I want to argue that Aquinas would see the just wage argument as referring to not distributive justice, not what the government gives you to make up for your lack, but what the employer owes you. If you look back at that Leo XIII quote, I think that's what he's saying. It's not the government that owes you that addition, it's your employer who does. Since the church bases just wage teaching on the needs of worker, it's commutative justice, not distributive. Distributive justice can come into play in things like Christmas bonuses or funds dispersed to employees for various purposes, like education funds, sick leave, maternity leave. This isn't to deny that distributive justice can be given based on performance, but need would take precedence based on the principle of liberty. As for generosity, think of this as like the donations an employer gives back to the community. Employers, noting the various needs of employees as a matter of moral due, should give directly to them when hardships arise. Or maybe they set up a nonprofit that their employees can apply to and other people in the community can apply to. And then finally, social justice. I think we should avoid thinking of this as money, like it's giving people money. It's more about helping the employees to participate in the community life. So in this case, this might include things like directing company time to helping an employee in need. So imagine that you have a heating and cooling company. An employee has an emergency, you know, breakdown of their system in the middle of the winter. Well, we're going to send a truck over there. No questions asked. That's just the boss does that out of a sense of moral responsibility to care for the human being who's human beings who depend on them. Maybe we're going to organize a volunteer work day. Hey, you know, John's laid up. Anybody volunteer on Saturday morning, we're going to go provide these sort of communities. So that's the better situation, where we're thinking more in terms of a cooperative community than in terms of just, you know, money that we give to one another. If you had to choose, when you go out from college, between the company that provides for your material needs, and like how many days off abstractly, but provides no community, and treats employees like it does the widgets that it produces, versus the one that meets needs out of a commitment to you as a member of the community, it's the latter that the church is envisioning. They might not be able to pay you as much. They might say, look, I know the bigger firm is going to give you a higher salary. We can't compete with them. But here's what we can offer. We can offer a community. That's the vision here. Okay, one final point, and then we'll look at church teaching today. Aquinas thinks of human law as limited in its ability to right wrongs and forbid immorality. So if you look at quote I there, Aquinas says we really have to tolerate things that are immoral in human law, because the attempt to remove them would do more harm than good. What we really need to think of with human law is providing a basic foundation for other intermediaries, families, parishes, schools, etc., to help provide that formation that builds upon that very basic, let's say, like soil of the seed being planted. But divine law leaves nothing unpunished. That's where pastors come in, right? That's where the church comes in, to think about really directing in the fullness of this. I'd encourage you to look at people like St. John Chrysostom, whose homilies are really heavy-hitting on these issues. If you're someone who has abundance, the things that he says that you owe to other people. I also do want to mention this. A very challenging issue is the low wages that parishes and dioceses give their own employees. It's crazy low. It's very low. And so you want to think, okay, is the church actually living up to this teaching? That's a can of worms. I would at least try to give a partial defense in that they ideally try to make up for this with immaterial and spiritual goods. And that's a way of trying to think about that kind of issue. But that's a good Q&A kind of question to address, to think about that. All right, so now we're going to, the rubber hitting the road a little bit here. Philosophers, the rubber rarely hits the road fully, but at least we're going to try and make a little bit of contact here. The main point that I want to drive home is that private property is entrusted to people to use for the common good. But abuses of this duty does not necessarily entail a loss of property. It doesn't mean the government can take it from you, even though you've abused your property right. In short, a classic example from ancient philosophy. The government can't send agents. So I first gave this talk in Catholic U, and I didn't think anyone here needs super abundantly warm coats. So none of you probably have that problem. Catholic U, you want really big warm coats. Okay, so imagine the government goes through your apartment and finds your super abundant AC unit and says, hey, your guy next door, he doesn't even have one, and just takes it from you. That's not what we're talking about here, right? That, on the one hand, yes, there is a kind of injustice there. The guy next to you, or the old woman next door who might die because she can't afford the air conditioning, you're treating her unjustly. But that doesn't mean the government should come in and take it. If you want to give it to her, I wouldn't discourage that, right? But I don't think we want the government to be called in here. Quote A, which I'm not going to read here, from Pius XI, makes this point very forcefully. Second, quote B, this does not mean, on the other hand, that the government has no right to intervene in cases of unjust wage, but only that it should be a last resort. The government is last resort. Something like when we go to a judge when we can't settle a dispute. That should be the last thing. And actually, good lawyers will say this, right? You don't want to lawyer up. That's the last resort, you know? We want to avoid going to trial if we can. Or we go to a doctor when we can't treat the illness at home. You know, I can't do it at home. We need to bring in the authority. Okay. And that's in quote B there. Quote C, again, note that Aquinas, social justice comes into play only when the employee can't meet the needs through the contract. In addition, and this is the other side you may have been wondering about, what if I can't afford to pay my employees enough? I mean, I'm not exactly living high on the hog here. I'm a small business owner. What about me? The church does address that and say that even in addition, that through no fault of your own, if the employer can't provide it, they can still operate their business if the only alternative would be to close the business, right? But if you're the employer and you're thinking, like, I don't really want to give up that really nice vacation that my family has, I'm going to have to think about that. Maybe I do have to say, well, if he's not even getting enough to live on, he's my employee. I'd have to at least think about that question. On the other side, the employee is guilty of injustice, you know, if they don't put in the fair day's wage. And we, the consumers, can be the ones guilty of injustice if the reason that small business owner can't pay is because we are buying goods more cheaply somewhere else, or because the government's taxation and regulation system makes it impossible for that small business owner to operate with a profit. Okay, and quote C goes through all of that. Finally, in D, and then we'll look at, you know, some concrete situations. When John Paul II discusses a family wage, he talks about an alternative way of meeting the needs of employee through social measures. So again, the company could say, hey, we give you a base contract. We recognize you're going to probably need more than that for various reasons, and we set up a community that provides for that. Those are social measures. It could also be governmental assistance. There's nothing in church teaching that says, well, and if it were government, local, state, federal, international, what level should that be in? Again, this isn't the ideal, but there could be benefits to having the adjustments for individual need met by governmental policies, distributions. Okay, examples. Tax reductions for married couples and their children. Education grants based on household income, factoring in size of families. Anyone dealing with the FAFSA right now, you know this issue is very frustrating, the way that the government has changed those regulations. Social service, providing free or subsidized food, shelter, etc. This does generally come at the cost of community formation. It's like anytime I call the police because you're making too much noise, I'm indicating we have a dysfunctional community, right? The ideal would be, hey, let's try to figure out a way to, you do your thing, I do mine, and we try to be respectful rather than bring in the government. But that's not to be ruled out. Okay, think about things like people discriminate against unjustly when applying for jobs. You know, that we might need the government to be involved in that. And I think that is really worth recognizing that when the government tries to adjust our salaries based upon different needs, it means that you, if you have five children, and you, if you have a mother you're taking care of financially, that your employer doesn't say, I'm not going to hire you because it's going to cost me more. Right? So the government can help us in some cases. There are concerns there, though, of allowing the employer to treat each of us on merit and then say, the additional parts you need, I'm not going to have to provide that as your employer. So I don't have to think about that. So particularly with women in the workplace, this is an issue, of course, right, of saying that, well, if I hire a married woman and she gets pregnant, then I'm going to have to pay for her marriage leave or for her maternity leave, and so I'm going to hire a man in that circumstance. Like, if the government's addressing that, that does help us to avoid that problem of an injustice there. Okay, so finally, theory to practice. Right. So what does this have to do with minimum wage? You notice I've been focusing on just wage, not minimum wage. Church social teaching is not public policy. I'll say it again. Church social teaching is not public policy. It's a 130-year plus tradition of applying the gospel to modern life. It's somewhere between theory and practice. It's supported by Aquinas' theories of justice, and it's a valid application of that. The teaching on a just wage is primarily a moral claim about what justice entails for the wage labor and the employer, and by extension, a claim about the role of government in supporting justice. This bears on economics, of course, but it doesn't tell us how economies operate and what the effect will be of certain market conditions or the government's regulation of them. So this is the general point. The church doesn't have a teaching on minimum wage. The magisterium doesn't extend to political economy. And determining the effective means for securing justice requires knowledge of economics and the prudence of statesmen that the church does not claim to possess. Do popes and other bishops and prelates have opinions on these matters that we should listen to? Yes. But we should not mistake them for church teaching. So here's an example, quote A. Pope Francis wrote Easter Sunday Letter 2020. This may be the time to consider a universal basic wage which would acknowledge and dignify the noble, essential task you, the workers, carry out. I think Pope Francis makes it clear he's not speaking magisterial. He's inviting us into a conversation about just wage. Doesn't claim to be a master of economics. He's presenting one of the proposals on the table, Anyone who cares about justice for workers should examine it, and then civilly, charitably defend or critique it. We should be wary then of those who tell us that the church teaches what policies should be in the workforce, as distinct from saying the church teaches what a just and charitable society will provide. This applies to any topic. So we should be cautious about making claims like, quote, the government's policy on immigration is contrary to or supported by the church. We should be very cautious about claims like that. The church aims to inform the mind and heart of Catholics and people of goodwill, leaving it to them to form themselves as citizens, who will develop the knowledge and prudence necessary for putting teachings into practice. All right, so I'm going to do four things here to wrap up. First, we need to add one principle to the issue of just wage. Subsidiarity. You've heard the term subsidiarity before. It's quote be there. The basic point is that the community of a higher order shouldn't interfere in the life of the community of a lower order. So in general, if we're thinking about how to meet the needs of people in our community, we should be thinking local government. We shouldn't be thinking federal policies. Say, how does my, I have a borough, I guess you have parishes, right? How is my government, people I actually know that live near me, my mayor or whoever it is, helping to ensure people their needs? And if they can't do it, maybe we bring in the next law. And if they can't do it, but we want to start with the local. Second, the key figure in the church in America, as I mentioned, is John Ryan. Really encourage you to read him, even if I have strong disagreements with some things he says. I think I'm going to skip that. But basically, John Ryan is teaching a Catholic view when FDR becomes president. And he is derisively called by another Catholic, the radio priest, Father Coughlin, the Right Reverend New Dealer. He was so pro-FDR's New Deal that some Catholics thought that he distorted church teaching. And I do think that's the case. I think there are ways in which he got so embedded in this secular activism of just wage, you know, disputes that he, I want to say inadvertently, I don't think he intends to, that he distorts church teaching. Third point. Things get complicated pretty quickly, just wage teaching. And again, I'm not an economist, so I just wanted to give you basically what are the two approaches. Governmental regulation approach, generally today we'd say like progressive, maybe even socialist, communist, and then free market. Okay. First, let's take the government regulation approach. I don't deny that some of this can work, some of the policies that we have in the government, but there are three concerns. The first one is that the policies tend to remove the church from the role of providing moral formation. The government tends to replace the church for forming consciences. The second one, centralizing power in the state is a concern, given especially today the problematic view of the human person in our culture. The church entering into the state's view of the human person as a kind of self-creator, that's going to get into our health care policies. The third thing is the massive cost of the administrative state. How much of that money that's supposed to be helping the poor is going to bureaucracies? But on the other hand, the free market. There are many free market advocates who critique church teaching, claiming it misunderstands how markets operate. I think they're missing the mark. I think they're failing to distinguish between the moral claim and the economic claim. The church is telling us what ought to happen, whatever economic policy can bring out of that. So if instead we work within the free market, we would need to reject or greatly de-emphasize the importance of minimum wage laws, and instead focus on a Catholic leaven in the culture. A culture that tries to encourage employers and employees to promote the common good. So we could think in the 20th century of like Mother Cabrini, missionary sisters, the Knights of Columbus, or even Dorothy Day on the more liberal side. And so if we were on this view, would the approach by Catholics be something like an alternative society? Like maybe you've heard of the Benedict option, some kind of alternative economy within the broader distributism being an example of that in a certain way. We'd also have to say, what is the difference between moderate and decadent living? Do Catholics in general live moderately or decadent? And do the things that Catholics claim when they say, I don't earn enough to support my family, actually mean I don't earn enough for decadence? Because my neighbors, who are living decadently, can do things I can't do. So are Catholics actually living out the gospel? Or are they actually demanding, caving to secular culture? Another thing is, do we want the one-worker household model, which is what the church was originally envisioning, with the father generally being the primary wage earner, or should it be the two-worker? One last thing is tithing. How much do we owe to our parishes, to our dioceses, to the church more broadly? And how much do our employers need to give us so that we can do that? And that now involves a relationship with religion, of course, morality, economics, and politics. So I hope this has provided you with some things to think about and reflecting on for your own life when you go to apply for jobs and you're thinking of those questions like, am I going to stay in here where I grew up? Or am I going to go for that job that maybe pays higher and hopefully someday come back? Or am I going to... These are questions practically we need to think about when we look at what we need. And then finally, this is the last quote on there, to remind ourselves that the goal isn't to allow us to participate in the American dream, but to transform, using the 2,000-year tradition of the church in thinking about it. And quote D, the rich man is not the one who has collected many possessions, but the one who needs few possessions. And the poor man is not the one who has no possessions, but the one who has many desires. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.